Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Now, Dominic Raab has been talking this morning about the prospect of a no deal. Katie, what has he been saying?
So today is another day of the no deal technical notices. So to mark the occasion, he has taken to the airwaves. And I think what is making the news is, rather than the specific details of what so far, if we look at the previous one, have been quite dry notices, is two things he said. The first being that Britain would not pay or might not pay all the divorce bill if it leaves with no deal. And secondly, talking about John Lewis and business warnings and whether a loss in profits can be blamed on Brexit. On the first, this is actually something he said before. This isn't the first time, but it turns out perhaps if you say something in Parliament at a very dry committee, less people pay attention than if you say it around 7 a.m. on the Today programme. But it is this idea that actually, in a no-deal Brexit, they wouldn't pay all the money. And I think that shows that the government is trying to play a bit harder with their tactics. They're trying to do a bit of hardball. But you've already seen the EU side try and, you know, dispute this. And there have been tweets from the Brussels figures this morning, you know, making the point, well, what's agreed has been agreed. So I'm sure there would be a wrangle if the UK government did try to do this.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to say you won't pay the full $39 billion. You should obviously pay what your legal liabilities are. Interestingly, a House of Lords report suggested that the UK actually had no legal liabilities. I mean, the House of Lords is hardly a hotbed of kind of pro-Brexit sentiment. Because it's worth remembering that if there is no deal, everything else in that December agreement, the transition, everything else falls away too. So, you know, it's a reset at that point. I think, though, that so I think you see this is kind of typical of kind of Dom Rom's approach to the whole negotiation, which is an attempt to kind of toughen up some of the UK's language and push back a little bit on Michel Barnier. And I think sometimes that works. I mean, there's a lot of feeling in the Tory party, even among people who are not particularly pro-Brexit, which remain, that with Dom Rom, at least someone is kind of slightly pushing back on Michel Barnier. He's not just basically being able to kind of say whatever he likes and there's no response. But I think sometimes Dom Rom can be perhaps a little bit too intellectually aggressive. And I thought some other comments on his media run this morning when he basically said, oh, he was asked about John Lewis blaming Brexit for some of their profits, and he basically said, bad businesses blame Brexit. I thought was perhaps a little bit unnecessarily harsh. And I think that, you know, the Tories have got to be careful, which is, yes, there are, I suspect there is some truth to what he is saying. But, you know, picking fights with businesses, especially a business that everyone basically likes, like John Lewis, is not always the smartest idea.
Katie, this isn't exactly a Boris Johnson-style fuck business, but it does say something about the way the Tories are now interacting with businesses who criticise Brexit, isn't it?
Yes, and I think Brexit has been interesting for many reasons, but one of which is it has meant that some Tories feel like the party's having a bit of an identity crisis because it was naturally seen as the party for business. And it means that relationship has been a bit fractured and lots of businesses feel there's too much uncertainty. In fairness, I think in this type of negotiation, there is always going to be uncertainty. It is unavoidable. But I think Dominic Raab's blunt way of talking does show that actually there's a big portion of the party who don't think that is their first priority.
Well, moving on to the Salisbury poisoning, Russia Today has published a video with the two suspects claiming that they only went to Salisbury to see the sights, James.
The spire of the cathedral, apparently. Now, on the one hand, this is deeply comic. It is such a ridiculous description of why they went to Salisbury. You know, they flew over from Moscow a day trip to look at this cathedral spire. They went to a place twice. They set off to walk to Stonehenge on foot, which is, you know, I think it's 18 miles away from Salisbury. In a way, you end up laughing at it. But then you remember that someone actually died because of this, and it becomes slightly more serious. I think this is typical of something else, which is the Russians really don't care. That they kind of the use of Novichok in the first place showed that they wanted people to know, or they didn't care if people knew that they had carried this attack out. You know, it's that old KGB saying had it. You know, any fool can commit murder, but it takes an artist to make it look like suicide. There are lots of ways that they could have killed Sergei Skripal, which might have given some people in the security services suspicions, but it wouldn't have been anywhere near as open and shut as this has been. And then to come up with such a poor cover story as this for why they were there. Again, it's saying, like, we don't really care if you know. And I think back to, you know, the people that the British state accused of killing Alexander Litvinenko. You know, one of them ended up marrying a go-go dancer and becoming kind of minor, kind of Russian D-list celebrity. And the other one ended up in Parliament. And you look at these two guys and you wonder whether the same thing's going to happen with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the funniest, if we're going to find the funny side, is this idea that it had just this emergency quick stop trip just to see the cathedral, which means it doesn't really add up as a kind of a sightseeing exercise. I think even the people who like to think there are conspiracy theories here will struggle to take this seriously. And this is a tactic that we know Russia use, which is basically to spread misinformation, and just, it doesn't have to be credible. You just have to put lots of different theories out, and it means there's enough doubt to try and, you know, undermine the truth.
Now, James and Katie, you've profiled a rising Tory star in this week's magazine, Tom Tugendhat. James, what did he say to you that was interesting?
I thought he said three things that really struck me. One is that there should be this kind of generational shift in the Tory party after Brexit, which, now you can say, oh, Tom Tugendhat is an MP who arrived in 2015. He would say that, wouldn't he? But that is a feeling kind of quite widely shared across the Tory party. And interestingly, someone who was doing some focus groups on possible leadership contenders recently said that the focus groups at the moment seem to kind of, what they're interested in is someone they've never heard of before. If they haven't seen the person, they start off better disposed to them than anyone who they know who they are. So I think there is a kind of public desire for that. I was also struck that he thinks there should be a kind of joint defence, development and diplomacy budget of 5% of GDP. Now, that's serious money. That's finding another kind of, on the back of an envelope, another kind of £45 billion.
That's red meat to the Tory membership, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, it kind of sums up what Tugendhat's possible appeal would be, which is, on the one hand, it's red meat, but because it's also diplomacy and development, it's not quite a kind of crude as, you know, let's just spend lots more on tanks. And then I thought the other thing which was interesting was the way he talked about, you know, how kind of getting back to kind of the David Cameron era, you know, the Cameron era in terms of optimism, inclusivity, all of that. You were reminded during this interview that Theresa May actually comes from an earlier Tory intake than David Cameron, that, you know, almost they view as a chance of kind of, you know, this is an interruption to a kind of the modernising project.
Katie, do you think Tom Tugendhat is popular in the Conservative Party?
I think it depends which part of the party. Obviously, as we mentioned in the piece, I mean, the reason that he has come to be better known is not just that he is good at throwing barbs at Boris Johnson. It's because he was the first of his intake to be elected to a select committee chairmanship. And that means that he had to be fairly popular, because that is votes through the MPs. So he managed to do what wasn't really the done thing, which was to oust Crispin Blunt, you know, his senior, who was seen to be quite well liked, from that position, because he got more votes from him. And some of that was cross-party, but it did mean that you had to have a sizable chunk of 2015 and 2017 say, yes, we think this guy is good and he should have that role. So I think he's fairly popular. But I would say what's been interesting with this generational change comment is some people have been quite pro it. I don't think it's perhaps that surprising that the people who are pro this idea tend to be the ones who
are in that generation.
Are young enough to be in that generation. I particularly enjoyed a George Freeman tweet this morning, which has said it's spot on. And he says that he's completely right, that the next prime minister has to be from the 2010/15/17 intake. I mean, Tom's technically 15 and then 17 onwards, but it's good that George has managed to just get it back a bit, so he's in it also.
James, what does he need to do to shape up and appeal to the previous intakes?
I mean, this is always the question, which is the big challenge for anyone running from the 2015 intake of Tory MPs is the 2010 intake of Tory MPs is the largest in the party. And if someone from the 2015 intake gets it, that's essentially the end of their chances of getting the job. So I think that, you know, that is a big challenge for anyone running from that intake. And I think it's no coincidence at the moment that, you know, you look at the front runners I would say at the moment in the parliamentary party, it's probably Sajid Javid and Dominic Raab, both of whom are kind of 2010 intake people. There is definitely a feeling among that 2010 intake that kind of this is their time.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. It's 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, plus a free limited edition Spectator branded thermally insulated water bottle. Just go to spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.